This is Cyril Pidge Palmer, interviewed by Chris Eldon Lee on the 1st of February 2013. Pidge Palmer, Part 1.
If you want to stop at any time, just say. But the first question is always the toughest. I need your name and your place and date of birth, please.
Cyril Hugh Palmer, 27th of May 1929. Salford, Lancashire.
So how old are you now?
83.
And where did Pidge come from?
When I was at school, originally, because of my size, I had a nickname Squibs, which went to Squidge and then to Pidge, and that stuck.
So you went into Fids with the name in place, did you?
Hmm.
Would you say your father was an educated man?
Yes.
What was his profession?
He was in the Navy.
Does that mean you didn't see much of him?
Well, during the war, of course, I didn't see him for 3 years at one stage. And of course, I was evacuated during the war to Lancaster. No, he was away quite a lot.
What did he rise to? What rank?
He was... I forgot what they call it. He was a master gunner, also, like the sergeant major in the army, or company sergeant major.
So he would have been on the equivalent of the front line at some point, would he?
Oh, yes. Mm.
Do you remember the ship he was on?
No, he was on Arctic convoys as well during the war, I recall.
What was it like back home at that time?
Well, I wasn't home. I was evacuated to Lancaster.
What do you remember of that period, Pidge?
It was quite happy, actually. I was fortunate in getting nice people to live with. They didn't have any children. And I stayed with them until I left. I got a scholarship to Lancaster Grammar. And I stayed with them until I took my school cert. And then went home to Salford.
Had you got thoughts of going into further education?
No. I wanted to go to sea.
You did? Like your dad?
Mm. But not in the Royal Navy, in the Merchant Service.
So what was the next step in your career then, or the first step in your career?
I went to Radio College in Manchester and got my, those days it was called the second class PMG, Postmaster General Certificate, and got a job with Blue Funnel in Liverpool.
Actually at sea?
Yeah.
What was your first ship?
It was an ex-Liberty ship called the Samoa. All the Americans, when the Americans built all the Liberty ships, they all gave them all the name Sam something, and so they were always called Sam boats. And they were built, you know, quite quickly during the war to supply stuff to the UK.
So what's a Liberty ship then? I've not come across this phrase before.
That's what they were called, Liberty ships, on the American program.
It was a class of ship.
They were all very similar. It's like that one there. Now that was my first ship. Then they got a better and bigger class called the Victory ships, which were bigger, faster and...
Bigger tonnage?
Yeah.
Yeah. And you were in the radio room, were you?
Yes.
How did you take to learning the art of radio, learning Morse and all the other quite technical material you have to cope with when you're a radio man?
I can't answer that.
Did it come naturally?
I imagine so, yeah.
Yeah. What were your duties then? What was your job as such?
Keep a radio watch, and we did a four-on, four-off regime.
We're talking about the late 40s now with this?
Yes, 47 on.
So you didn't do national service then?
No.
This exempted you, I presume, did it?
But after I came back from FIDS, they sent me call-up papers.
Did you go?
No. No, I explained what I'd been doing, and they excused me.
I think at that time, working for FIDS did actually eliminate your need to go to national service, didn't it?
I think so, yeah.
One or two FIDs got caught out because they didn't make the arrangements before they went, and like you got call-up papers when they came back.
Yeah.
Were you happy with Blue Funnel?
Yes, yeah. Yeah, it's quite good. They were a good company to work for. In fact, when I joined FIDS, the company said I could have leave off pay and keep my seniority until I came back.
And did you?
No, I joined another company, in fact, Union Castle.
Why did you apply then to FIDS, Pitch?
I was in Melbourne. And the ship's doctor was Australian, and we were in Melbourne for 3 months because the dockers were always on strike at that time in Australia. Yeah. And I had a girlfriend who had a small hotel, and staying at the hotel was a major and his wife on loan to the Australian Army, and he worked in St Kilda Barracks. And I was familiar with the ex-inspector of the Australian government's radio inspector who'd retired, but because of all the strikes, he'd taken a temporary job as a tally clerk. And of course, he introduced himself to me, brought the magazines, the radio officers' magazines for Australia, and in it there was an advert for the ANRE wanting radio operators. And I mentioned it to this major chap, and he said, "Oh, I'm in the next office in St Kilda Barracks to Philip Law, who was running the ANRE at the time."
ANRE is...
Australian National Antarctic Research Expedition.
Okay.
And he said, "Would you like me to have a word with him?" So he did that. It was fortunate.
Yeah.
Had the interview. They accepted me for, was it Macquarie? And, of course, I had to get the UK and back again in time. The company said they would give me passage back on my ship. But I had, on the way home, I wasn't too good, and the doc said, "I'm going to give you a full medical." And he came up, he said, "I think you've got sugar diabetes." So, but he said he couldn't give me the proper tests until I got back. By the time the results of the tests came through, which are negative, my ship had sailed, and so I couldn't get back in time to join the ANRE. Wrote to Philip Law, and he suggested that I contact FIDS, which I did, and got accepted by them, of course. So had an interview at the Crown Agents.
Do you remember that that interview at all? Long time ago.
Not really. I thought it was quite short. I think her name was Barbara Wells. I can't remember much about it, no, as I say.
Did you get the sense that it was a formality and that, looking back on it, you already had the job before you walked in?
I think so, yeah.
Unless you messed it up, I suppose.
Yeah, because of the qualifications, really.
Yeah. They were looking for radio ops.
Yeah.
You'd already been accepted by the Australian equivalent, so you can't have been that bad.
Yeah.
What was it that made you want to apply to go to the Antarctic?
I never wanted to drive a train or anything. I always wanted to go to the Antarctic. Simple as that.
Always?
Yeah.
Can you remember where that spark came from? That?
Yeah, reading Scott's books and Shackleton, who was my particular hero.
This was a boy, was it? A schoolboy, yeah. Reading. Scott doesn't have a happy ending, though, does it?
No.
But Shackleton, you took to him as well.
Yes, yeah.
And if I just push you a little bit further on this, what was it about those books, those stories that inspired you? Bravery, or?
Oh, I don't think so.
No.
Oh, well, they were brave.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
I don't mean you,
yeah.
Pidge.
Yeah.
Was it just the whole concept of going somewhere so different?
Yes. Yeah. That not many other people had done, of course, as
especially
well.
In 1955.
54, I went 54 to 57.
54 you set off?
Yeah.
Yeah. How did you get south?
On the Biscoe.
How was that?
All right, yeah.
It's quite a small ship compared to what you were used to.
We were bunked up in... quite different now.
Yeah.
And then when the Shackleton came, I came home on the Shackleton, and that completely different, of course.
In what respect?
Well, you had a separate cabin for a start. Instead of the mess on the Biscoe, I think the bunks were three high.
Yeah.
And 20 odd of us in this small space.
Was it a friendly ship? Did you get on?
Yeah.
I guess you were making contact with people who were in the same position as you, going south for the same reason.
Yes, and I was also, of course, friendly with the radio officer on the ship. And I used to do some of his watches occasionally.
Was that out of curiosity or just giving him time off? Or?
Just, spell off.
Yeah. Do you remember Port Stanley?
Yes.
What do you recall?
A village type place.
People say it looked very Scottish.
Well, I don't know what Scotland's like, so I can't. As I've never been, well, I've been there, yeah, on just to the airports, and that's all.
Yeah. Well, at what point did you learn where you were going to go in the Antarctic?
At Stanley.
They divided you up at that point?
Yeah.
Yeah. And you were being sent to Deception Island?
Right.
Which is not quite the Antarctic, is it, really?
No.
Was that a disappointment?
It was a disappointment, yeah. And I was made base leader by, what was his name, the Governor Sir Miles...
Clifford.
I remember he had a saying, you don't have to be scruffy to be tough. And so when we built Danko, we had a plaque made out. On it was, you don't have to be tough to be scruffy.
Did he have a sense of humour, Clifford?
No, I don't think so. Well, of course, I didn't have much contact with him anyway. Just a brief contact.
I was intrigued to learn to know why you were made base leader. Do you know? Because you've not been before, had you?
No. I don't know. I suppose I shone out over the rest of them.
Perfect answer. Was it an onerous position to have?
No.
On a small base?
No. It's a bit annoying, really. I mean, paperwork. I mean, you didn't go down to have to mess about with stores and stuff. No, it was all right.
Bit of extra money, I think, wasn't it?
£10 a year or was it? I can't remember. And it was slightly more, yeah. And I think the pay was about £1 a day in those days. I don't think it was much more than 360 a year. So the extra £10 was... I can't remember exactly, but...
But it was worth having, was it?
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah.
How did you get to Deception?
On the Bisco again.
Talk me through that going into Deception Island. What did you see and hear and experience? You were on the ship and you were going towards Deception Island. Can you remember the process of arriving?
No, just calling in at other bases and, you know, loading their supplies, offloading their supplies.
And when you got to Deception itself, I mean, the name gives it away, doesn't it? It's difficult to see how to get in.
Mm.
Were you impressed with the arrival?
Yes, yeah.
Tell me about it.
And the fact that, you know, there was already a base hut there. Quite old, of course. But, it was... We're glad to be there, in fact, you know, eventually.
Did you ever get a sense of why you were there? Because there was no flying at that time, so it wasn't... Later it was used as an aircraft base, wasn't it? Winter.
Yeah.
We're overwintering for aircraft. But in your time, in 55, before the aircraft, why do you think Britain was so keen to put men on that base?
Well, part of the claim to that sector of the Antarctic against the Chileans and the Argentinians. And, of course, there were Chilean and Argentinian bases at Deception.
So you were aware of the political
underscore? As base leader, I was given protests to hand to any foreigner that came around our part of the woods, and they'd give you one back and you'd have a party.
What were the protests? What did they say, these notes?
They hadn't had permission to be on Her Majesty's territory.
And they gave you on back in Spanish, presumably?
Right, yeah.
Which you could or couldn't read?
They couldn't.
How did they get on with the South Americans?
All very friendly indeed, yeah, especially the Chileans.
Well, why is that?
I don't know, they were just... we used to visit each other occasionally. And you get the odd ship coming in, of course. Besides the Bisco.
So apart from...
Of course, they were all military people.
Well, that was a big difference, wasn't it?
You
wanted to be there, in theory.
They were posted there more. And they got triple pay and medals and for being there. And they didn't do anything either. They were just there.
Well, what did you do?
Well, we had like a small survey program, and although we didn't forget his name now, he had although he wasn't a geologist, he had a bit of a geological program.
Try to look him up. It's interesting. There's no geologist here.
No, he wasn't a qualified geologist. He was given a program, that was all.
Clark, Cooper, Gilpin, McDowell, Phipps.
Clark.
The Met Man.
He was, a Met Man, but McDowell was the was the main man. And, well, they were all the others. Ray Cooper was the diesel mech. And the other four were all MET assistants. That was their title.
So the geology was a bit of a sideline, was it?
Yeah, yeah.
Was Clark just collecting samples, or what was he doing?
Collecting
rock samples?
Yeah, and he was doing fauna, flora, and stuff like that. He had this little program. I can't remember, of course. I think he was either going to university or was in a break at university as a geologist.
Would that be an official program then, sanctioned by FIDS, or would it be just him doing it?
He was doing it with FIDS approval.
Right. So the main job then was meteorological work.
Yeah.
That's why you were there.
Right.
Apart from the raising the flag.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tell me about that then. What were they doing?
Who, the Met?
The Met men, yeah.
Well, just the Met observations.
What? Do you remember anything in particular that they were doing?
No. Just their job.
Okay. I've got your report here.
Oh, really?
Annual General Report, Deception Island, 1955, by C.H. Palmer. At least I've got part of it. And what sings out from this is just what a terrible state the base was in.
Yeah.
What do you remember?
Did you say it was all right. It was comfortable. The wind wasn't whistling through the windows or anything. It was in a dilapidated condition. We tried to repair places.
You did a lot of work on it, I think, judging by this. The main hut on the north side is in extremely bad condition. The outer wall is bulging outwards to reveal several places where there is extensive rotting. Sections of rotted wood were knocked out, the holes filled in with cotton waste soaked in bitumastic and covered with rubberoid roofing felt. The rot is so extensive, however, that this patching was not continued, as it was thought that it may weaken the structure. And you hadn't got the proper tools or the timber available. This is you in 1955. So it really was a mess, was it?
Yeah.
So did you set about trying to improve it for future years off yourselves? What was the thinking?
Oh, yes, yeah. But those people were coming next. And Ray Cooper, the diesel mech, was a really good hand. Really. He's an ex-RN stoker. And he'd been in the naval climbing team, in fact. He was really tough, good hand. He went to Canada after we left, and he was a good electrician, a good mechanic, and he got a dog team and was going round the Arctic repairing people's generators and electric and things. Married an Eskimo lady in eventually.
Mm-hmm.
Never came back to the UK. Asked me if I'd like to go out there and join him. But no.
What do you recall of the other chaps? McDowell, do you remember him particularly?
Yep.
What do you make of him?
Nice, very efficient. He was he was Met Office, real Met Office chap. The others were recruited as Met assistants, but they hadn't been with the Met Office at all. Yeah, McDowell, nice chap.
Brian Gilpin?
Yeah, they were all good.
So did you all get on okay?
Oh, yeah.
And did you find yourself as base leader having to make any tricky decisions or deal with any tricky situations?
No, not at all. No, I was surprised that we did get on so well, really.
Do you put that down to the selection process?
No, it's a bit haphazard, isn't it?
So it's just luck, really?
Mm. Yeah.
And possibly also the fact that you all knew you were there for a year and you couldn't afford not to get on.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. I'm reading more about your report here. There were several window frames missing, which you had to repair, and you built a settee.
Oh, yeah.
Tell me about that.
There again, Ray was the instigator of that. We got some timber from packing cases and things, and we found a load of canvas. And so one of the rooms we turned into a bar and built this settee for. I've got the photograph of it somewhere. And the Chileans and the Argentinians came to a party we had for the first time to christen the settee.
A small bar and shelves were constructed in one corner of the sitting room, with a 6-foot by 3-foot settee built from old crates and packing cases. This was stuffed with an old tent and wooden shavings, and the whole covered with canvas and then painted. Not exactly IKEA, is it? Was it comfy?
Yeah, yeah, great.
And how did you keep that living room warm?
Did we have a stove in there? I can't remember, actually.
Shall I prompt you? A stove was placed in the room, fitted with a temporary insulated steel sheet chimney made at the base. You must have made the chimney. This, however, was not entirely successful, and it suggested a new one is installed when the new stores arrive. So I guess it didn't draw terribly well.
No.
Do you remember being cold, or was it okay?
No, it was reasonable.
And you were doing photography as well, obviously, because you've got pictures.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, developing them on the base?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Was that something a skill you had before you went?
Something what?
Was that a skill you had before
you
went?
Oh, no. No, but it became very difficult when we were at Danco, of course, because we didn't have any electrics. We didn't have a generator. But you're still going on with deception, are you, really?
Well, it doesn't matter. Yeah, we don't. There was no generator at Danco.
We did get a generator. We had 3 wind generators, right?
Yeah.
And Lucas, as you probably know, make an established wind generator that had been used as standby on the bases for years.
Okay, I didn't know.
But this was a new type. So we erected the first one. There's a photograph there.
It was rather flimsy.
Mm.
Yeah.
And the first, as you probably know, after a certain wind speed, they're supposed to furl and stop working so they don't burn out. Well, that mechanism didn't work on the first one and it burnt out. So we put the second one up and that same. The next strong wind we had, it burnt out. Put the third one up, and it happened again. All 3 burnt out. So we had no way of charging our batteries.
At Danco?
At Danco.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that meant Fred Wooden, who was a very keen photographer, we built In the loft, we built a little room, and we used to develop the photographs by tilly lamp. Had the tilly lamp outside for the, you know, to, for the, and that was Fred Wooden's. He did that, and we'd take occasionally a battery to the nearest Chilean base, get it charged up. You know that we had, one bottle of gin, lime juice and whiskey per year per man, I think. And I think it was half a gallon of rum, uncut rum, you know, navy rum. So we used to take a bottle of that with us to get the battery charged. And we'd get a case of Argentinian or Chilean wine in return for that.
So how, this is at Danco, how did you run a base with no effective generators?
Well, we just got on with it, didn't we? I mean, I had a pedal generator for communication, but didn't do much of that because it meant somebody sitting there pedalling while I was on the key.
Yeah. So you...
So we made it known that we weren't really in, you know, we wouldn't be making regular communication.
But would you have lights in the evening at Danco?
No. No, we had tilly lamps, of course.
Yeah. But, right. So, I forget what the science was you were doing at Danco. Was there any science going on there?
Yeah, we had a geologist, and Fred Wooden, of course, a surveyor,
yeah,
and John Ketley.
So there's no scientific science?
No.
As such, so they didn't need the power?
No, no.
So you got away with it, I suppose?
Yeah.
I hadn't realised that. Thank you. That's really interesting.
I don't even know if they supplied a generator for the second year after we left. I don't think so. Don't know what they did.
Back at Deception, there's a word in your report I didn't understand called a vibroverter.
Sorry?
A vibroverter. Does that ring any bells with you?
No.
No, okay. So we can find that.
What was that about then?
Well, that's what I'm asking. That's what I'm asking.
Vibroverter?
Yeah.
That was that in my report, you said?
Yeah.
Oh. Interesting. Sounds sexy, doesn't it?
It does. I don't think it was. Were you worried about a fire at all at Deception?
Worried?
Yeah.
If it happened, yeah, you would. Yeah.
So what precautions did you take to avert it?
Well, we just used to take care with everything and know where the various buckets of sand were. And
you did quite a lot of reorganisation of the fire precautions.
Yeah.
I think repositioning extinguishers and buckets of sand. And there's quite an interesting passage about recommending that antifreeze be added to the water tanks.
Yeah.
Because you were fearful that the tanks might freeze up in the winter and therefore you couldn't fight a fire with lumps of ice.
Right.
Remember that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Did you do much sledging at Deception?
Not a great deal, but we had dogs, of course.
Seven, I think, is that right?
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Well, we just used to do what we could with the... Ray Cooper again looked after the dogs. He was very good.
Would you get far?
No. Yeah.
Was there much snow to sledge on?
Yeah, yes.
Mm-hmm. Would you go sledging yourself?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So how did you take to that yourself?
Difficult.
difficult. Can you elaborate?
Sorry?
Can you elaborate?
No, I don't know what to say, really.
Why was it difficult to...
Well, initially, of course, so then you got used to it, controlling the dogs. And of course, none of us had any experience, of course, and... but it was a lot of fun as well.
You say you had no experience, but in fact, all six of you on Deception Island that year, none of you had been south before.
No.
Was that a disadvantage, not to have any old hands in the team?
I think so, yeah.
So what kind of problems did that throw up, the fact that there was no experience on base?
I can't think of any.
Okay. Did you feel confident about running a base?
Oh, yeah.
With amateurs, effectively?
Yeah.
Okay.
They're all good hands. So.
One of your jobs was to maintain the lighthouse, wasn't it?
Yeah, I can't remember much about that.
Do you remember the radio gear?
Oh, yeah.
Tell me about that.
Oh, ex-naval stuff. What was the CR300, I think, was the name of the type of receiver. And it was the transmitter was a huge thing, about 6 foot tall. And an ancient... valve-driven transmitter, of course. None of your transistors in those days. Yeah.
How far could you reach?
Well, used to... I had an amateur licence anyway, and so used to talk to people all over the place, especially in Chile. VP8BH was my call sign. In fact, I've got one of them there.
Could you reach Britain?
Oh, yeah.
So you're speaking to people in this country?
Oh, yeah.
Some bases, they use that as an unofficial way of talking to relatives.
Mm.
Tell me about that.
Well, we didn't do that, of course. I just communicated with other hams.
But could you pass messages to your folks back home?
Yeah.
So you...
If you were... in contact with someone, and it was probably near one of the chaps, and he'd say, would you mind giving them a phone call and saying everything's okay, things like that.
Yeah. You're mentioning in your radio report of that year that the batteries are all well past what we now call their sell-by date. These batteries are all manufactured in 1949 and clearly marked expected storage life 9 months. And here we are in 1955. So was the gear reliable, or were you being let down a lot?
No, it worked. It worked all the time. I was very lucky. Because, there are no facilities to test any equipment, really, if it had gone down. So I was quite lucky.
No repair facilities, you mean?
Yeah.
No. Yeah.
And we had no standby gear. If the main transmitter had gone, we would have had no means of communication at all.
How important was the radio?
Very. Yeah.
So the fact there's no standby was a bit chancy, a bit risky, was it? Yeah. I guess you were sending Met figures back to Stanley.
Yeah.
What else was it being used for?
That's all. Just the Met reports, really. And when the aerial survey people came...
Huntings?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The equipment they had, International Air Radio, was running the radio station. In fact, George... get his name... was the chap in charge. And I met him in Tripoli, Libya, when I started flying for Silver City. I was in Libya for 3 years, and he was running the IAL station there. And Jim Greenshields, one of the Cancel pilots, when I was in Chittagong flying for Pakistan Shell, a survey aircraft landed one day when we just landed, and we went across to have a word with the crew, see if we could, you know, if they knew anything, were they staying, what were they doing, or were they in transit. Jim Greenshields was one of the pilots on that aircraft.
And he was a Huntings man, was he?
He was a Huntings man.
So when did Huntings arrive then at Deception?
When?
Yeah.
Just before I left to go to Danco. Yeah.
So did you...
And I didn't get on with Mott, of course.
You didn't?
No. Because he came ashore, right, I'm in charge here now. And so we didn't get on too well.
So, can you elaborate on that? Can you give examples?
No, he was, you know, he wanted to take over everything. We gave him the use of, there was an emergency hut away from the main building. And we opened that up for him for the radio station. They had some porter cabins, as I remember. And we let him use our kitchen for the cook, which was a good advantage, really. They had a cook, so we didn't have to bother anymore.
Do you remember a chap called Roy Wood for Huntings? Developing the photographs back in base. No, different year maybe.
No.
So did you and Mott ever come to verbal blows?
No.
But you, and you maintained your authority?
Hopefully.
This sudden influx, after just being five or six of you on base, for the Huntings team to arrive that second summer, effectively, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Must have been quite a change.
Yes, yeah.
Did it get livelier?
It's a good change, obviously.
Was that your first kind of close encounter with flying?
With flying?
Hmm.
Yeah.
Did you go up?
Yeah, on one trip, yeah.
Tell me about that.
No, it wasn't my first encounter. When I was in Singapore on one occasion, a cousin was in the RAF, a pilot, and he was based at Changi. And whilst I was there, I went to stay up in the officer's mess with him. And that was my first trip. He said, "We've got a test flight tomorrow. Do you want to come up with us?" Which was on a Dakota, a DC-3.
Yeah.
That was my first airborne experience.
But you also got one at Deception as well?
Yeah.
Tell me about that trip.
Well, it was on one of the Cansos. And also in a Chilean helicopter. They gave us a ride round once.
Was the Canso doing a survey run?
Yeah.
Can you describe anything of that?
No.
What visual image do you have in your mind at the moment?
What?
What image do you have in your mind at the moment?
Just... I don't know. It was just a trip, really.
You must have enjoyed it, though, I suppose.
Oh, of course, yes. Yeah.
Do you think you were sowing the seeds for a later career at that point?
No.
Okay, well, we'll come to your flying career later on in the interview, if that's all right. That's all right with you. Okay. One of the things you say in your report about the radio, the transmitter was extremely difficult to service, and if a major fault developed, there would be a lot of work involved to strip the set. In its future, it is suggested that the main transmitter and receivers be standardised with the equipment on relief vessels. So what was your thinking there?
Well, get some modern gear.
But also possibly that if your radio was the same as that on the ships, then...
You could do a swap.
You could get some spares.
Yeah.
But did they pay any attention to your recommendation, I wonder?
Doubt it.
You doubt it. Okay. And there was something about frequencies too, that you were recommending that everything be on common frequencies. I'm not quite sure what you meant by that.
No, I can't remember what.
It's also suggested that to simplify communications with sledge parties, etc., all bases have the same type of set, all with the same, underlined, frequency range, a range between 3 and 6 MCS probably being the best. That suggests you'd had struggles at times to reach people by radio.
The sledge sets were, again, army, ex-army equipment, and they were really crap. You get, and of course, we didn't. It wasn't a need at Deception. We did try them out, of course, but at Danco, we needed them, and they were not very good at all. They got the moisture, you know. If you in fact, they mostly failed.
They let you down, did they?
Yeah, yeah.
Did that cause problems, panics?
Well, at Danco, I said if the sets you can't use them properly, we had a code to click the transmitter button. One for yes and two for no, so you would be asked questions, and the person on the sledge set would respond with a it happened on two or three occasions that the set failed.
But you could still hear it going, being switched on and off.
Yeah, so that you know, you were in contact with them.
Are you in danger? Yes or no.
Yeah.
Do you need help? Yes or no? Yeah. Okay. The sledging equipment generally, you reckon, was fairly inadequate at Deception?
Yeah, well, it wasn't a sledging base anyway, so... And we did repair and get a Nansen sledge in good condition, in fact.
So you overhauled the sledge, did you?
Mm.
Yeah. Okay. Any boating?
We had a dinghy, of course. We used to go sealing and round to the in the summer, round to the Chileans or the Argentinians.
Seals were in short supply, I believe.
The seals?
Seals?
Yeah, yeah.
For the dogs?
Yeah.
And I get the impression he had two boats, but only one working outboard motor.
Did we have two boats? Yeah, we did.
Both dinghies have been well used, but only one outboard motor has been serviceable due to a fracturing of a drive shaft on the other engine.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
So boating was just really to get to the lighthouse and to collect seals?
Yeah.
And really. Visits?
Yeah.
Okay, did you ever go outside the bay, the volcano?
No.
Okay. And I love this comment from you, Pidge. The steak and kidney pies, as supplied, are a waste of money. Do you remember them?
The?
Steak and kidney pies.
Oh, yeah.
What was wrong with them?
not like mother made.
The meat content is small, the suet pudding is very poor, and was always thrown away. So
there's quite a difference, you know, with the Argentinian and Chilean. The Chileans had a cow in calf and sheep and chickens that kept in their emergency hut. And they chop one down occasionally, you know, and have fresh stuff. The Argentinians had a freezer about as big as this room, which was stocked with Argentinian beef and stuff every year. And so they were on fresh meat most of the time. And so we had these bloody steak and kidney puds and dried vegetables, and they couldn't believe it, that they couldn't believe what our food supplies were like.
Was that embarrassing, inviting them back to your base for hospitality?
We never invited them for a meal. Right. We used to get invited for meals, but we never had them back for a meal.
Why do you think your food was so poor compared to theirs?
Well, we didn't. They had. Well, I suppose they thought about it a bit. But the Argentinians built a freezer in the Antarctic, you know. And the Chileans thought, well, we'll have live stuff that we can knock off now and again.
Do you think perhaps that Bass could have done more to provide you with gear and sustenance?
Yeah, I don't think they thought very much about the food supply.
Or indeed the equipment.
Oh, I mean, we got dished out with string vests, flannelette pyjamas. It was really inadequate. Fortunately, most of us had our own gear, you know, instead of, well, like most of us thought about the severe weather conditions and bought gear, fortunately, because I say string vests, all ex-army gear or navy stuff.
So was there a sense you weren't really being looked after as well as you might?
Yeah.
Was this resented?
No. We just have to get on with it.
Yeah. How were relations with HQ? Because so far away, there's always that temptation to imagine that management don't really know what's going on.
Well, management should have known what was going on because they'd all been involved themselves, which surprised us really that they hadn't made any improvements on what they'd been with.
This occupied your mind quite a bit, I guess, from your base report, that things could have been so much better for very little extra effort.
Yeah.
Do you think it was a shoestring budget?
Yes, obviously. It's much better now, isn't it? See some of the gear that they've got. Amazing.
Are you impressed?
Yes. Mm.
Would it be the same, though, do you think, going back now? If you were going there now, compared to 60 years ago?
No.
How do you imagine the difference is to be?
Well, look at the accommodation for a start. I mean, it's... And the facilities and the... You know, it's all, you know, completely different. Completely.
Different kind of person?
Probably not.
Oh, okay. Let's pause and then we'll pick up again in a few minutes' time and talk about Danko more.
Okay.